Do you know how to tell the differences between the sciences? If it moves, it's biology. If it smells, it's chemistry. If it doesn't work, it's physics. The demonstration of physics is in the book. Real quick test, so I find out sort of what you know and what I can say. If you know the following terms or what they represent, just raise your hand real quick. COPE, ICMJE, WAMI, CSE, CROSS-CHECK, the Peer Review Congress, McMaster University. Is it Claudia from McMaster University? Consort? Equator? Okay, good. Well, my training is in medical technical writing. I've worked mostly with clinical journals for the last 20-some years, I guess. So my comments will be specific to clinical journals, but they may generalize as well. And what we're going to talk about is keeping the litter out of the literature. We'll look at ways to make the literature more useful and a little bit less confusing. As we were going through the speakers today, I had to change some slides because somebody already had the point that I want to make. First of all, do you recognize this? What is this image? Anybody know? This is the Egyptian god Thoth, or Thoth. And what you see, the blue and yellow line by the leg is actually the symbol for the scribe. Because it turns out that the Thoth is the Egyptian god of medicine and the god of writing. So this association between writing and medicine goes back a very long way. First case reports are in ancient Egypt and hieroglyphics and so forth. Incidentally, Thoth is believed to be the origin of our word thought. So no extra charge for that. So I want to talk about the relationship between writing and science, or publication and science. And the first of these is that science can't exist without writing. You see the characteristics of science up there. And the only medium that really supports those criteria is writing. This is the original table of the elements. You can see the building blocks are vent and scum, with some Belgina and prowl and so forth thrown in. A wonderful book by Tom Weller called Science Made Stupid. But the reason that I include this is that when the periodic table of the elements comes out of books on tape, I'll take back my statement that writing is what allows science to exist. Well, another part of the association that's mentioned several times is that publication is the final stage of research. If you don't publish your results, it never happened. And implicit in this is that you publish in a peer-reviewed journal. The journal was invented for the relief of those either too indolent or too occupied to read old books. It is a means of satisfying curiosity and becoming blurred with little trouble. Anybody know who Dennis DeSalle is, or was? Anybody? Dennis DeSalle was the guy that invented the scientific journal. January 5th, 1665, he produces the first scientific journal, the Journal des Savants, pissed the British off because France needed to do it, so on May 5th, 1665, they began publishing Proceedings of the Royal Society. Both journals are still being published, although not necessarily original content. And finally, evidence-based medicine is literature-based medicine. The idea here is that we need to, again, use the data that we've developed before so that we can get the best guess as to what relationships are going to work in medicine. We'll comment on evidence-based medicine. The problem is that there's not a lot of evidence, and there's even less good evidence. But we'll talk about that in a moment. So I thought I'd keep with the theme of environmental cleanup and talk about the ways in which we can improve the medical literature. The first thing I need to do is to educate. And I go back to this again, this relationship between writing and science. And the writing that we learn in school is not the writing we need in science. Now, I distinguish between basically three kinds of writing. And I added some slides, I don't know where they are, but we'll do that. Which is the literary writing that we all learn to do in school, journalistic writing, and then medical technical writing, which is completely different from the other two forms of writing. This is what we need to do in the sciences, but it's not what we're trained to do. See if this doesn't sound familiar. In school, we learn to write for a single reader, who knows more about the topic than we do, and who doesn't have to use the information in any functional way. Does that sound familiar? Okay? But in sciences, we have to write for a few to a few thousand people, to people who know less than we do. In fact, that they're reading our work is because we know something that they want to know. And then finally, this is the key to medical technical writing, the outcome is behavioral. Purpose of medical technical writing is to help people act. And that means the information that we give people needs to enable them to do what they want to do or make the decisions that they need to make. In school, we learn how to communicate with words, and for most people, writing is words. I went to a workshop on tables and graphs taught by a medical writer, and in 3 hours, only 5 tables and graphs were shown, because that's not what this person learned. She was a PhD in English and did medical writing, and it just didn't occur to her to put examples of tables and graphs on your workshop. And so in science, we need to learn how to communicate not just in words, but also with images and statistics and graphs and diagrams and so forth. So in other words, the writing that we learn to do in school is backwards. The flow of information goes from ignorance to knowledgeable, and we don't learn essential skills. One of the things that my profession has is this sort of a pre-review. It's not peer review, but it's clarifying review, if you will. And I've come up with this category of levels of review. Now, lots of people look at a manuscript between the time it's drafted and the time it's published. And my hope is that people will begin to move down toward the as close to peer reviews we can get. Level one is editing for basic English. This is language-based review. And this is necessary because of the incredible outgrowth of publications from countries in which English is not the standard language. Typically, journals get more articles than they can screen, so the secretary looks at the language. If there's too much Chinglish or Yaglish or whatever, they send it back right away because the resources don't exist to process that, even if they're not doing research. Well, once you get past the basic English, then we have a level of copying. This is rule-based review for formatting for the journal, make sure the tables look the same way, and that sort of thing, reconciles is consistent. And then third, we have substantive editing, which is logic-based review. And this is a more in-depth level of editing. Copy editing you can get pretty cheap. A lot of people are supposed to do it. Substantive editing is a little more intensive. And here the goal is to look at the whole piece and make sure that everything is consistent. If you've got 50 patients in the research or the results section of your article, we would expect to find 50 patients in the tables and graphs. Oftentimes we don't. We did a research project at the Cleveland Clinic to test our suspicion, and sure enough, 2/3 of the papers we received for editing at the Cleveland Clinic had mathematical errors in them that even we as editors could find. Numbers didn't total, percentages were computed incorrectly, ratios were reversed, and so forth. Now, so substantive editing is, you can get substantive editing, a little more expensive, but my professional activities for the last 30-some years, I started when I was 12, is what I call analytical editing. And this is checking the documentation of the research, which will become important in a minute. Much of the research in clinical medicine is very poorly reported, not just poorly written, but we don't know certain things about the research that we need to know. And again, more about that. And then finally, there's peer review, which is validity-based review. peer review is very content-driven, that sometimes it's supposed to look at analytical editing, but sometimes it doesn't. Let's look at some things here. So analytical editing is designed to make sure that the statistics, the research designs and activities are reported completely and accurately. We must know some reporting guidelines. Most of you did not know about CONSORT, is that correct? CONSORT is the first of what I call the standards movement in medicine. It started with evidence-based medicine in the early 90s. And CONSORT is a list of now 25 items. Each item requests certain information that are considered to be the minimum information necessary to evaluate the validity of the study. So if a journal says we accept the CONSORT statement, what it's saying is that you have to make sure that your article addresses each of the CONSORT requirements, and on a little checklist here you indicate on the manuscript or on the checklist which manuscript page solves each of these requirements. There are also specific kinds of tables and figures that one would need to know. Receiver operating characteristics curves, Kaplan-Meier curves, line tables, that sort of thing. And we must also know something about research methods and sources of error confounding bias. And when editors can do this stuff, we're going to improve the quality of that paper substantially. Although I have to tell you that there's a truism in medical writing, which is that when we clarify the meaning, we sometimes coincidentally reveal it. So here's a schematic, and it just shows the what I hope is the increasing ability of people to do more intensive levels of review. There's a little more content necessary for analytical editing, and certainly a lot for peer review. But oftentimes in medicine, peer review is focused on medicine, not necessarily on the research designs and activities, which is the analytical editing part. Well, the next thing we can do to get rid of litter is to reduce waste in research. Now, I think Jevon, I think, mentioned this about the incredible pressure that many young physicians are under to publish. I see this a lot in the teaching I do in Asia, particularly China, where if you get published, if you get a paper published in a journal with an impact factor of 3, you get a bonus of $3,000. Or if you want to be promoted, you have to publish in a journal with an impact factor of 2.5, depending on the discipline. And the pressure to publish is amazing, but they aren't given the resources necessary to do research, like training, supervision, resources, clinical research associates, biostatisticians, medical librarians, and so forth. So the result of this is pressure to publish and the lack of resources means that these folks study things that can be studied instead of something that needs to be studied. And that produces a lot of unremarkable research, but it still consumes inordinate amounts of resources. This is some work done by Sir Ian Chalmers, a wonderful man. And he's listed basically the four areas of the research process where we could make a difference. In the far left, low priority questions. You know, asking things that even if you know the answer to, it's not going to change the way medicine is delivered all that much. Appropriate design and methods, more than 50% of studies designed without reference to systematic reviews. This is this silo thinking, where you're not going to look really at everything we know right now about a topic. We're just going to start and study what we want to study and hope for the best. Accessible for full publication. More than 50% of studies in medicine are never published. Mostly this is because the authors don't have the time, they don't want to take the time, the results aren't all that remarkable. And this is a problem. There was a problem too with industry-sponsored research and the suppression of research results, which actually led to the requirement now for clinical trial registry. So before you begin enrolling patients, you need to register your trial in the protocol in any of several databases. Clinicaltrials.gov is the main one. And that way we can know beforehand when to expect a study, so that people who participate in the study, who are being put at risk, that their data are not just suppressed because the answers were wrong. And then finally, unbiased and neutral reports. You will talk more about this later, but 50% of planned study outcomes are not reported, and 30% of the interventions are not described in detail. So we're not doing very well. But if we can stop the publication of these articles in any of these areas, we can improve the quality of the literature. Well, we can always reuse. If you remember those physicians who don't have the resources to do clinical research, they may have the resources to do systematic reviews and meta-analyses. And maybe what they can do is duplicate existing findings. Duplication is oftentimes noted as one of the values of science, but it's rarely done. And why not let that duplication be done by people early in their careers? That way they don't have to come up with a new idea. The protocol is there. Some of the pitfalls of the research are known. And we would get duplication, or not. But I think that may be a better way to produce good publishable work than to turn them loose and have them create ideas on their own. Well, finally, we can repair some of the data. This is the peer review process. Here's the need for peer review, quote by Roman Maggi, senior editor at JAMA. There seems to be no study too fragmented, no hypothesis too trivial, no literature citation too biased or too egotistical, no design too warped, no methodology too bundled, no presentation of results too inaccurate, no argument too circular, no conclusion too trifling or too unjustified, and no grammar and syntax too offensive or paper to end up in print. The short form of that is it's impossible to write a paper so badly that it can't be published. Now, the other end of the spectrum, a quote from Frederick Mostow, a very famous statistician. When a well-done trial or experiment or observational study is fairly, honestly, and thoroughly reported, it will have so many warts and footnotes and exceptions that it may be hard for the uninitiated to believe that the work was of high quality. It also means that anyone who's reading the literature, physicians or layperson, actually needs to know something about research to wade through all of that complexity. Well, critical appraisal is basically what peer reviewers are supposed to do, but often can't or don't. The time that peer reviewers spend reviewing in several settings goes from 45 minutes to 8 hours. Higher quality journals get better reviewers and longer reviews. But it's tough. I mean, there's a lot of time, it takes a lot of training to do it. And it's not just reading an article looking for errors. If you start with that, you're not going to end up with a very good review. What you have to do is assume that the research is absolutely worthless and make it prove itself to you every inch of the way, word by word, sentence by sentence. And it actually requires a lot of time, training, and perspective to do well. One of the things that medical writers and editors do is bring this different perspective to it. We'll talk more about the importance of perspective in a minute. But good and critical appraisal should find a lot of the errors that are currently in the literature and hopefully prevent the articles from being published beforehand. But here are some examples. So a systematic review of 2,000 studies on schizophrenia. They studied the wrong patients. They studied patients who were institutionalized, which is a relatively small part of the schizophrenic population. You need to study them in the community because that's where they're living, that's what they have to, where they have to cope. Studies don't study enough patients. The average sample size in this particular meta-analysis was 65, not great. But some of the questions that were being asked required enrolling as many as 600 patients to get the answers that the researchers were looking for. The studies were also too short, typically 6 weeks, but if you know anything about psychotropic drugs, it takes about 6 to 8 weeks before the drug takes effect. Probably the mayor of Toronto could comment on that as well. But I think also most interesting is the fact that these studies use 640 different endpoints. 369 were used only once.
And my guess is that there were 369 master's theses written on these particular studies. But without the common endpoints, we can't compare the studies. It's hard to do meta-analysis on them. It's hard to say that this was equivalent to that because there's no common endpoint. Which is why we need to do more systematic reviews before we do the study, so that the study can be designed with endpoints that are more comparable. I'd like to take a look at just a part of the medical literature, which is the problem of statistical reporting. It has three basic problems. The first problem is that authors use only basic statistics if they use any at all. Now, for time's sake, I'm just going to give you a couple of examples, but trust me, there are dozens of studies that show pretty much the same thing. Okay, and these articles in six internal medicine journals, 48% use chi-square test, 31% t-test. These are very basic statistical methods, and only 8% use non-parametric tests, which are actually pretty basic. But 17 is linear regression and so forth. Not a high percentage of advanced techniques. Pharmacy journals, pretty much the same thing. Only 20% or 28% is only descriptive statistics. Pretty common in many areas. And in a journal of burns, again, you see t-test and ANOVA. ANOVA is just the t-test plus more groups, so it doesn't necessarily have to be more complicated, though it often is. But again, not really statistically sophisticated methods. So in general, depending on the study, you get a range of up to 80% of articles in some journals use only no statistics or only simple descriptive statistics, mean and mode and standard deviation, that sort of thing. But 60 to 90% use the statistics that are taught in the first semester of a statistics program. So this is not complicated stuff. Maybe 20% use the more advanced methods. Well, problem two is that authors who use statistics make lots of mistakes. A quote, again, one of probably a dozen. These reviews reveal remarkable regression consistency, with typically about 50% of reviewed papers being found to contain clear statistical errors. Most of these errors are sufficient enough to call the author's conclusions into question. Archives of Dermatology, 364, you can see that only 43% included statistical analyses, a third had errors in admissions, a quarter had errors in presentations of results, and 14 had errors in the statistical methods. So, not a real good track record. Journal of Urology, again, 83% had errors in reported odds ratios, which is kind of hard to do, but they do. Three quarters did not report confidence intervals, which in medicine anyway are now preferred to p-values for reporting results. I don't know how you report a p-value correctly. Actually, I do. But for half of the journals not to do it correctly is just astounding. And then the errors in descriptive statistics. And in articles on animal research, you can see that the error rates, again, are very, very high. Methodological errors in RCTs. Notice that every RCT should have a sample size calculation to determine the to have adequate statistical power to find a difference if one is there. They should all give the details of random assignment and of allocation to consumer. These are all part of the consort guidelines. Notice that, again, the number of, the percentage of articles that actually report what needs to be reported is very small. How many of you are aware of the Cochrane collaboration? Okay, so in medicine, the use of meta-analysis and systematic reviews has been consolidated in a group called the Cochrane collaboration. The idea is to assemble all the information about a particular topic so that you can analyze the data in its totality. There are Cochrane groups all over the world. There used to be four Cochrane centers in the US. I think we're down to two. One at UCSF and one at Brown University. But this is considered to be the best of the best. I know several Cochrane reviewers. They are some of the smartest people I have ever met. And one of those people actually analyzed the quality of the Cochrane reviews. And even 29% of the Cochrane reviews had errorism, 17% in supporting conclusions. Again, not a real good track record of quality. So again, to summarize, about 70% of articles reporting statistics have flaws in them. And probably 10% of those articles probably should never have been published. They had fatal flaws in the design. And even though Cochrane reviews are better than non-Cochrane reviews, they still have lots of errors. And so the conclusion of this is that the overall quality of the medical literature is not all that wonderful. And in fact, this problem of statistical errors in the literature is widespread. It's been found in every branch of medicine study. Every country that has looked at its own journals has found horrendous error rates. It's long-standing. There are quotes back as far as the 1920s about statistical problems in the literature. First P-value measures in the medical literature in the mid-1930s. First major study, statistical flaws, appears in JAMA 1966. And since then, probably 350 studies have been done documenting this particular problem. As I mentioned, it's particularly serious because in many of those cases, the stakes are so great that we call the author's conclusions into question. It's also largely unknown. How many of you thought that the medical literature was reasonably good until this amendment? Yeah. Okay. Pretty serious. But curiously, most of these errors concern only basic statistics. And even worse is that the studies on statistical flaws were not done in the Antarctic Community Medical Bulletin. Okay? They're being done in the major general medical journals, the New England Journal, Animal Sciences, JAMA, BMJ, and in the major subspecialty journals, chest, brain, all the EHA journals, and so forth. So this has been a real problem for a long time. And the third problem is that nobody's doing much about the first two problems. We may talk about that in a minute. Now, as Glenn mentioned, I was sort of called into the last minute to pinch hit for a speaker who could not be here. We certainly hope that she and her father are doing better. But I worked real long and hard to make this happen. It was tired, I was late, and I couldn't resist putting in another example of littering, which is that given all the errors that we find in the biomedical literature, maybe we have raised peer reviewers to a status a little higher than they deserve. If we look at the characteristics of peer review in medicine, and it's probably quite different than the physical sciences where there are different endpoints, different methods. This is sort of what we find. In fact, peer review is not very good at determining whether an article is published or not. It is sort of successful in putting better articles in better journals, but even then, reviewers' comments can differ wildly. When I was at the clinic, I got an author came in with his paper. He said, "What do I do?" He showed me the reviews. And one reviewer said, "This paper is too clinical." And the other reviewer said, "This paper is too much basic science." Well, the journal editor is supposed to resolve that issue, but it didn't. So you have wildly different reviews. Peer review is time and labor intensive. There's really no rewards for it for the peer reviewers other than being thanked once a year and a copy of the journal and whatever professional association they make through that. And again, you can see the other things up there. There's some evidence of bias against women foreign authors and competitors. It does seem to improve the presentation of scientific articles. People are generally happy with the changes they make in the presentation, but not changes in science. But in rejected articles, there's a lot of evidence to show that the authors do not use the first set of reviews to modify their paper before they send it to the next journal, which means that it's basically a waste of time. Peer review is not going to go away, and I don't think that it should. We need to have people who are specifically looking at the published result of that research and looking to evaluate. evaluate it as best they can. There are certainly an awful lot of different ways of looking at peer review, different ways of setting it up. And the Peer Review Congress, which is a biennial congress, actually started by Drummond Winter, who we mentioned before. That consists of people who are interested in improving the medical literature. And it started off specifically focusing on peer review, but now is a little broader than that and includes how to improve the quality of the literature. I just want to call out one thing, that it was very unpopular for a long time among reviewers to have to give signed reviews back to the journal. It's now considered unethical in medicine to publish an anonymous review. So if you review an article for a journal, you sign it, author sees your name, the public sees your name. And I don't know what else it does, but I bet you anything that it makes people more polite. How many of you have read peer reviewers' comments that were like a little bit on edge? You know? I wish that the people who review my articles would read the paper before they started their review, you know? There's always one. Well, there are some organizations working very hard to improve the quality of the literature. The metaphor here is the EPA, and my definition of that extended abbreviation is every paper analyzed, which is really what they want to do in the interest of improving the literature. The International Committee of Medical Journal Editors was probably one of the first standard-setting agencies in medicine, at least for scientific publications. And its origin was actually within a couple hundred yards of where I stand. There was a secretary named Augusta Whitworth who got tired of retyping her boss's papers every time the paper was rejected by one journal and had to be reformatted for another one. So she contacted the editors of the major medical journals, general medical journals. And 10 years later, there's that lag time again, they convened in Vancouver, Canada, formed an organization called the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors, which started off by issuing a standard bibliographic reference stock, which is wonderful. It has a minimum of punctuation. It's simple. It's very easy to do. Unlike the APA system, American Psychological Association, which will drive you nuts with all of its ins and outs, completely unnecessary. The ICMJE consists of about 17 journals, and it's tried to be more international, but these are the gods that sit on Olympus and sort of dictate. If this group says to the world out there in medical publishing, we're not going to publish your journal unless you do this, people pay attention, because they have the authority to back that up. Now, the World Association of Medical Editors is an organization of the principal scientific editors of medical journals throughout the world. It was formed in response to the ICMJE. It is much more egalitarian. We are a virtual organization. And I will tell you that one of the highlights of my life, I happen to be the treasurer. And so the only physical address that he has is my home. And when I ordered the checkbook, the package came and they had truncated the address, and so the address said World Association of Tom Lang. Doesn't get any better than that. In 1997, the consort statement was published. And this set of reporting guidelines for randomized trials became the model for many, many other reporting guidelines. So there's trend and stroke for observational studies, there's stigma for genetic studies, genetic association studies. There's a whole mess of these things. And finally, this is the same group that began putting out these standards for reporting, formed the Equator Group. So equator.net is the website where you can go and look at the reporting guidelines for, the last time I checked, which was some time ago, there are about 125 guidelines for reporting research designs and activities. Some are very specific, like the one for acupuncture, non-pharmacological interventions. And then the other half are guidelines for reporting specific procedures. Remember we talked about the 369 different outcomes for the schizophrenia studies? Some of the ideas that you can get here are, because it's very specific, like intravascular ultrasound studies, the standards will say we want you to collect data on these outcomes so that we can compare studies. And that is an attempt to make the literature useful, or more useful than just individual studies that, that can't be compared. How many have heard of COPE, Committee on Publication Ethics? Excellent resource. This organization started in 1997, now has more than 7,000 members. And they handle the ethical issues of publication in science. They started off in medicine, now it's all fields of science. If you go to their website, you'll see flowcharts. And the flowcharts indicate the kinds of decisions that you need to make for any given particular infraction, authorship disputes, retracted articles, claims of scientific misconduct, and so forth. Very, very useful to people in medicine. The Council of Science Editors, how many of you know CSE, okay? This is an organization of the principal scientific editors of all journals. It started off as the Council of Biology Editors, so it's still heavy in life sciences. But again, this is a group that is writing white papers and working to improve the literature by setting standards. The European Association of Science Editors, EAS, is the European equivalent of CSE. Again, they're putting out style manuals and guidebooks to help journals and so forth improve the literature. Well, I'm going to end, no pun intended, with a note on perspective. I think this was mentioned earlier about the importance of different perspective. If you look at the causes of poor statistical reporting, you have to know that there were no comprehensive guidelines for reporting statistics in medicine. And how can you expect the problem to go away if you don't tell authors how to solve it? Also, the journals didn't have requirements. You don't have to report your statistics in this way. And they didn't have that until earlier this year, in 2013. And again, how can you expect errors in the statistical literature or the biomedical literature to go away if you don't tell the authors what you want? Now, the interesting question here is not why did an obscure medical writer write a book on how to report statistics in medicine? I'm not a statistician. I have no business writing this book. Okay? I wrote it for my purposes as a medical writer editor. The real question is why wasn't this book written by a statistician, a journal editor, a clinician, educator, and so forth? I think that represents a surprising finding to me. And the same thing with journals and reporting guidelines for statistics. We've come up with some now, a model set called sample guidelines. And again, why is it that someone from outside the field is putting this stuff together instead of the journal editors or the peer reviewers or the publishers? And I think what this tells me, and the point was made earlier, is that we can all work on the system. We don't have to necessarily have to be part of the system. In fact, the perspective that we bring from outside the system may in fact be the most important thing that we bring. We will see things that other people don't see. We will not make assumptions that other people assume and take for granted. And so I think this just argues for all of us working on the same problems to improve the literature. And with that, I'll close.